the Lord, to whom all praise is due forever and ever. One of the happiest of all Jewish holidays. It commemorates the story told in our biblical book of Esther, the saving of the Jewish people from extinction many centuries ago in Persia. King Ahasuerus had been persuaded by his prime minister Haman to issue an order that all Jews in his kingdom be killed. When Queen Esther, who unknown to the king was herself a Jewess, learned of this from her uncle Mordecai, she went before her husband to plead for her people. Haman's plot was foiled, and he himself was hanged on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. The book of Esther, in addition to being bound in its regular place in our Hebrew Bible, appears also in separate form as a very beautifully illuminated scroll called in Hebrew the Megillah. Before the Megillah is read in the synagogue, three Hebrew blessings, appropriate blessings, are first chanted. We shall hear these blessings now, then Rabbi Jick and I will read those verses from the book of Esther in which Haman first incites the king against his Jewish subjects.
In the Hebrew blessings now being sung, God is thanked for his help to the Jewish people in every generation and for commanding us to read the Megillah. The final blessing expresses our gratitude that we have been preserved another year to celebrate Purim again. This is a modern English Megillah, published by the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. It shows how the story of Purim has been illustrated.
Vayomer homon lamelech Achashverosh, yeshno am echod mefuzor umeforod bein ho'amim b'chol medinos malchusecho, v'dosehem shonos mikolom, v'yes doseh hamelech einom osim, v'lamelech ein shoveh lahanichom. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from those of every people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it profiteth not the king to suffer them.
Im al hamelech tov yekosev li abdom, v'yaseres alofim kikar kesef eshkol al yedei osei hamlocha lahavi el ginzei hamelech.
If it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those that have charge of the king's business to bring it into the king's treasuries.
Vayosar hamelech es tabato me'al yodo, vayitno lohomon ben chamdoso ha'agogi, sorer ha'yehudim. Vayomer HaMelech Lohomon, HaKesef Nasun Loch V'Ho'om, La'asos Bo Katov Be'enecho. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And the king said unto Haman, The people is delivered unto thee and all of their wealth, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee.
Listening to the most famous of all Purim songs, Shoshanas Yaakov. It is a poetic eulogy of Esther and Mordecai, set to a melody based on old folk tunes. The title Shoshanas Yaakov means Lily of Jacob and refers to Queen Esther.
Very happy Purim to all of you. It isn't often that we're so fortunate as to have a Jewish holiday fall precisely on the day of a television program. Rabbi Jick and I wish to take advantage of this fortunate coincidence this morning by discussing with you the implications and significance of the story of Purim for peoples of all faith. Though it is true, of course, that Purim is a specifically Jewish holiday, meant to commemorate an actual event or pattern of events in Jewish history from past times, nevertheless, like so many other occasions on our Jewish calendar, it embodies ideas of great consequence and meaning for peoples of other religious and cultural groups also. Rabbi Jick, I think we owe it to our television audience this morning to disclose at the very outset of this conversation the fact that some doubt has been expressed by a good many scholars as to whether the events pictured in the Book of Esther ever actually happened as they are described here. How do you feel about the historical accuracy of this account?
Well, Rabbi Gittleson, I don't think there can be any question about the fact that there was a Persian period in Jewish history and that the general outlines of the times certainly are accurate. But there may be some question about some of the factual detail or some of the specific events which are described in the story.
Could you give us any idea of what the facts are which have led some scholars to doubt the historic accuracy of these specific events?
Well, many scholars have come to the conclusion that this tale is really an allegory, a historical allegory, which is based on general truth. But they question the specific events because, in the first place, there's nothing in Persian history that has been discovered, nothing that has been discovered through archaeology, which tends to verify the existence of the specific individuals and the actual occurrence of the specific facts. Furthermore, there are certain descriptions in the Book of Esther which tend to contradict common Persian custom and practice of that time as we know them from some of the literature of the ancient Persians. Of course, all of this is conjecture. We can't be sure. We haven't disproven the fact that the book actually occurred as it is described. And for that reason, each of us is free to draw his own conclusions on this score. What would your conclusions be, Rabbi Gitelson?
Well, I would be very much inclined to agree that this is a reasonable assumption, that perhaps the events told about in this book didn't actually happen in exactly the manner in which they're described here. I think, however, we must be careful not to react from one extreme to the other. For many centuries, it has been more or less assumed that the story of Esther took place in all literal detail, exactly as described here. Now, I suppose, understandably, but unfortunately, there's a tendency to swing to the exact opposite extreme and to assume that nothing in this story really took place. I think we've got to bear in mind that there are a number of distinguished scholars, Dr. Harry Orlinsky on the faculty of our alma mater, the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, is one of them, who feels very strongly that there are substantial elements of fact to be found nonetheless in this story. I like, in reacting to your question, Rabbi Jick, to think in terms of the distinction that we often make with the boys and girls of our confirmation class between truth spelled with a small t and truth spelled with a capital T. Truth spelled with a small t we usually use to refer to the factual, literal details of a story. Did it actually happen in the manner in which the Bible describes it? By truth spelled with a capital T, as you well know, we usually mean the allegorical implications of a story. Are there moral or ethical values which the writer or writers of these stories were trying to portray for us? And I think that in the second sense, truth with a capital T, there's a great deal for us to learn from the entire story of Esther and Haman and Mordecai. We learn here some of the pattern of what causes prejudice, not only against Jews, but against other minority groups. And I think we can learn also a good deal about the reactions which members of minority groups can or should have in the face of such prejudice. Along that line, I wonder, Rabbi Jick, whether you would care to comment on whether you think Haman has given the real explanation for his prejudice when he says in the verses that we read a moment ago on the pulpit, he says to the king, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from those of every people. Do you think that Haman, in so stating, has given the king his real, honest reasons for being prejudiced against the Jews of that time?
Well, one of the interesting and very valuable things about the book of Esther, and one of the very remarkable insights which it shows, is that it recognizes the difference between the causes for anti-Semitism and prejudice generally are quite different from the pretexts which are very often advanced by those who have this kind of view and try to justify their position. What Haman is mentioning is, of course, not a cause at all. It's simply a pretext. It is true that the Jews were different from other peoples, that they did certain things differently. It is, of course, as the rest of the story reveals, not true that the Jews did not obey the laws of the king. On the contrary, as we know, Mordecai had been of great service to the king and had actually saved his life. Therefore, this kind of pretext, the kind of pretext which uses some excuse for prejudice, is very often used. We see this in our own times, in the prejudices which people in our very midst have. For example, prejudices against Negroes are very often based on unscientific, unsound, and untrue biases, and people who know very much better use these kind of flimsy pretexts to cover up their feelings, which obviously have some very much deeper basis and some very hidden reason which they themselves may not be willing to admit or to understand.
Before we go into what some of the real reasons for Haman's prejudice may have been, I wonder whether it isn't worthy of comment to observe that the basis on which Haman has put his prejudice before the king is this: I will accept you provided you are uniform, provided you conform to exactly what I believe you ought to be. And this is, I think, once more a pattern which is of great cogency even in our time today. This is, I think, the fundamental crux difference between dictatorship and democracy. Dictatorship predicates acceptance on uniformity. It says to the individual, I will accept you if you think as I do, you look as I do, you believe as I do. Democracy, to the contrary, if we truly understand it, not only accepts difference, but indeed welcomes and encourages difference. Democracy recognizes that so long as the differing elements in a population or civilization
work in harmony with each other, work toward similar aims, goals, and objectives. Indeed, the greater difference there is between them, the richer is the sum total of civilization. The figure of speech has often been used in which democracy is compared, as you know, to a mosaic. The greater the difference of color, the more differing tiles in terms of color and texture and shape and form that appear in a mosaic, the more beautiful that mosaic is. And here then, in this behavior pattern shown by Haman, we have, I think, a fundamental difference between democracy and dictatorship. Unfortunately, even in our own time, as all of us well know, there have been those who, under the guise of fighting communism, have actually accepted the fundamental precepts and premises of communism, namely that everyone must conform to the majority norm if he is to be accepted. Well, now, having said that, Rabbi Jick, let me bring this parenthesis, shall we say, to a close. Do you think that we have any clue to Haman's real reason for his prejudice given us in this account in the Book of Esther?
Well, the Book of Esther very clearly and explicitly describes for us what the real reasons for the prejudice were. In the first place, it points out to us that Mordecai refused to bow down to Haman. This is obviously the cause of a certain kind of hurt pride. In the second place, it tells us that Haman wanted to bribe the king in order to gain the right to pillage the Jews and take away whatever possessions they had. This gives us the motive of greed, which is certainly a motive in all cases of this kind. And finally, it tells us that Mordecai had been of great service to the king and had actually saved his life. And this shows us that Haman was afraid, insecure, afraid of his position, afraid of anyone else who could do something good and who could be of service. These kind of incidents reveal the real motives which are behind the pretexts of anti-Semitism and of prejudice generally. Greed, insecurity, avarice, psychological fear, the fear of being inferior and of having some kind of an overinflated ego which requires artificial bolstering. This kind of an ego always turns to pushing others down, persecuting them, repressing them, so that it can establish some kind of artificial superiority and reassure itself that there is really someone who is inferior to it, that there is really someone that it is better than. And this is the way in which this kind of mechanism operates in the Book of Esther, as it has from that day to our very own.
Needless to say, of course, I agree with that. I can't help but wonder, however, whether there isn't even more than that, another possible reason for Haman's prejudice, which is given to us in this very verse to which you've referred. Mordecai's refusal to bow down to Haman, I think we can assume, though to be sure the book does not so specify actually in so many words, I think we can assume that Mordecai's refusal to bow before Haman was predicated on the fact that he was a Jew. And that Judaism, of course, has always taught that man must bow down only to God, never to his fellow man. This means essentially that Mordecai was following the pattern, or perhaps establishing the pattern, confirming the pattern of the Jew of being, religiously speaking, a nonconformist, not just for the sake of nonconformity, but for the sake of freedom in religious behavior, practice, and belief. This has always been the role of the Jew throughout history. We know, for example, that roughly 4,000 years ago, at a time when all peoples believed in worshiping idols, the ancient progenitors of the Jews included among them, it was Abraham, the very first Jew, who predicated the assumption that God was different from idols and could not be worshiped through idols. At a later stage in history, when all other peoples and religions believed that God wanted to be worshiped through the offering of burnt sacrifices, again, it was the great prophetic leaders among the Jewish people and the Jewish faith who first taught that this was not so, that God wanted the sacrifice of a contrite heart, of atonement and of good behavior, rather than the sacrifice of animals. And here I think we have, dear friends, a most basic reason for much of the prejudice that has through the centuries been directed against the Jewish people. We Jews have always stood as a symbol of freedom and nonconformity, a symbol for the right of the individual and of the minority group to believe what their hearts and minds and consciences dictate they must believe. Now, this is a difficult thing for many members of the majority to accept. We Jews have, in a sense, been the eternal Protestants, protesting with all the vigor and strength at our command against the imposition of uniformity. This is what Haman resented in Mordecai. This is what totalitarian governments and dictatorships everywhere in the world today dislike about the Jew. And this is, incidentally, why the Jewish people and the Jewish faith have always been, whether under fascist dictatorship or communist dictatorship, have always been one of the first and primary targets of totalitarianism. So I think, Rabbi Jick, that we actually have two things given to us in this story. We see, first of all, that prejudice was used by Haman as a psychological device to pump up artificially his own sense of superiority. And we see, secondly, that Haman was resentful of the fact that the people of Mordecai and of Esther were religious nonconformists.
It's interesting to note, Rabbi Gittleson, that this book, which understands prejudice and bigots so well, describes other individuals who are associated with this kind of behavior in such a clear-cut way that we can recognize them almost as being our own neighbors and existing in our own times. One of the most interesting individuals is, of course, King Ahasuerus himself. King Ahasuerus, as far as we know, was not a bigot himself. He was not ready to undertake any action, any hostile action himself. And yet it's almost amazing to the point of being ridiculous to see what his reaction to Haman's suggestion is. Haman comes to him and says, there is a certain people in the midst of our people which I would like to destroy. King Ahasuerus, in his ignorance, in his apathy, in his unconcern, doesn't even ask which people it is. He doesn't ask for any proofs of the accusations which Haman makes against this people. He doesn't investigate at all. He simply says, go ahead and do what you want to do. This, of course, is typical of the behavior of so many people. As long as they themselves are not directly affected, as long as there is not some kind of threat to them and their families, they're perfectly willing to sit by and allow others to be mistreated and maltreated and taken advantage of in the way in which the Jews were to be mistreated by Haman. This, I think, is indicative of a certain kind of behavior which is most common and most alarming in our own culture, in our own society.
Yes, and of course the king could always say, this wasn't my responsibility, I didn't do this. After all, I was just serving as a good executive. I appointed a prime minister whose name happened to be Haman, and I couldn't possibly check on everything he did. I had to let him take care of these details. So he could plead ignorance and say that it was not really his responsibility if the Jewish people had been destroyed. This, too, is comparable to the behavior, as you well know, of so many people in our own time. We have had, for example, those Germans, some Nazis, some not Nazis in Hitler times, who said, we weren't responsible. We didn't know what was going on in the concentration camps. Yes, we saw carloads of people being brought there, and we smelled odd odors at various hours of the day or night, and we saw soap being shipped back out of these concentration camps and crematoria, but we weren't responsible for it. We weren't there. We didn't do it. Likewise, we find in this country today, Americans, otherwise intelligent, otherwise conscientious, well-meaning Americans, who will say, prejudice is not our responsibility. We don't hate Negroes or Jews. We don't do these things. We're neutral. It has always seemed to me that one of the most valuable and important pieces of instruction for us to get from the story of Purim and the book of Esther that we've read this morning is the notion that there is no such thing, there can be no such thing as ethical neutrality. These things are the responsibility of every individual, particularly in a democracy. And no one can simply sit by or stand by and say, because I didn't do it personally, it's not my responsibility. In short, I think you will agree with me, Rabbi Jick, particularly in a democracy, the welfare of any one group must be the welfare and concern of every group and of the majority, or democracy simply cannot succeed.
I think all of us would agree with you, Rabbi Gittleson. And it's interesting to note even further than this, that just as in the book of Esther, Ahasuerus is the example, the symbol of the apathetic, so in a very real way, Esther too is a symbol. And there are many mixed elements in Esther, good as well as bad. We can't help but note that in the account of Esther, in the first instance, Esther achieves the position and the status of being a queen by denying, by concealing the fact that she is Jewish. Esther conceals a part of herself. She doesn't admit to what she is. And we know that even in the story as it is described, when the threat against the Jews becomes very real and Mordecai calls this threat to her attention, Esther's first reaction is a very hesitant reaction indeed. She doesn't jump at once to the defense of her people. Her first response is that there is great danger for her in going to the king, and she's very hesitant. We can only wonder what it is about an individual of this kind who has these elements in her that in the end makes her accept her responsibility, makes her really become herself and turn back to reality and turn back to being an honest person. And we can only speculate about the peace of mind which an individual like Esther must have won for herself after she really acknowledged who she was and honestly declared herself to be a Jewess. The book of Esther doesn't tell us very much about how well Esther slept before and after this event. It doesn't tell us whether she was concerned, whether she lived in a state of alarm and tension as to when she would be discovered and when her true identity would be revealed. But we can be sure without knowing the specifics that once Esther was accepted for what she was, and not because of a pretense, once she acknowledged what she was, she not only redeemed her people through her action, she also redeemed herself, and that she herself was restored and enabled to become a true person and enabled to live a rich and happy and full life by this kind of self-acceptance.
It's really an amazing thing, isn't it, Rabbi Jick, when we take the time to examine this story of Purim with a microscope or a magnifying glass and to see its overall meaning and significance, how very much there is in it, not only for us as Jews, for the members of all minorities, and indeed for the individual man or woman who seeks fortitude and strength with which to meet the vicissitudes of life. We simply have to be ourselves and accept ourselves. We're very grateful, dear friends, for this opportunity of having you look in and listen in on this morning's discussion. We sincerely hope that you have, each of you, benefited in some small measure from this half hour. Nothing would please us more than to receive a note from you, commenting either on this morning's telecast or suggesting, if you feel you would like to, topics for future discussion on one of these programs in months to come. Our next telecast will be 5 weeks from today, Sunday, April 21st. My discussion guest for that occasion will be F. Alexander Magoon, a former member of the faculty at MIT, author of the widely read and very popular and significant volume, Love and Marriage. I hope that you will be with us to hear the discussion between Professor Magoon and myself. And until then, until April 21st, goodbye and God bless you.
This morning's program was produced by Alfred Sherman and directed by Ted Factor. Assistant Director Tony Lang. The choir was directed by Herbert Frum. Our commentator was Frank P. Cohen. The next Temple Israel radio program will be presented on Saturday evening, March the 30th. Consult your daily newspaper for the station and time. This is Temple Israel.